Magnetic Ore Milling Work, Abridged from Edison, His Life and Inventions by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. Although this phase of Mr. Edison's diverse activities is not as generally known to the world as many others of a more popular character, the milling of low-grade auriferous ores and magnetic separation of iron ores have been subjects of engrossing interest and study to him for many years. Indeed, his comparatively unknown enterprise of separating magnetically and putting into commercial form low-grade iron ore as carried on at Edison, New Jersey, proved to be the most colossal experiment that he ever made. In the early 80s, Edison became familiar with the fact that the Eastern steel trade was suffering a disastrous change, and that business was slowly drifting westward, chiefly by reason of the discovery and opening up of enormous deposits of high-grade iron ore in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. This ore could be excavated very cheaply by means of improved mining facilities and transported at low cost to lake ports. Hence, the iron and steel mills east of the Alleghenies, compelled to rely on limited local deposits of Bessemer ore and upon foreign ores, which were constantly rising in value, began to sustain a serious competition with the western mills, even in eastern markets. Long before this situation arose, it had been recognized by eastern iron masters that sooner or later the deposits of high-grade ore would be exhausted, and in consequence there would ensue a compelling necessity to fall back on low-grade magnetic ores. For many years it had been a much-discussed question how to make these ores available for transportation to distant furnaces. To pay railroad charges on ores carrying perhaps 80% to 90% of useless material would be prohibitive. Hence, the elimination of the worthless gang by concentration of iron particles associated with it seemed to be the only solution of the problem. From 1880 to 1885, while still very busy in the development of his electric light system, Edison found opportunity to plan crushing and separating machinery. His first patent on the subject was applied for and issued in 1880. He decided after mature deliberation that the magnetic separation of low-grade ores on a colossal scale at a low cost was the only practical way of supplying the furnace man with a high quality of iron ore. It was his opinion that it was cheaper to quarry and concentrate lean ore in a big way than to attempt to mine under adverse circumstances limited bodies of high-grade ore. He appreciated fully the serious nature of the gigantic questions involved, and his plans were laid with a view to exercising the utmost economy in the design and operation of the plant in which he contemplated the automatic handling of many thousands of tons of material daily. It may be stated as broadly true that Edison engineered to handle immense masses of stuff automatically, while his predecessors aimed chiefly at close separation. Reduced to its barest, crudest terms, the proposition of magnetic separation is simplicity itself. A piece of the ore, magnetite, may be reduced to powder, and the ore particles separated therefrom by the help of a simple hand magnet. To elucidate the basic principles of Edison's method, let the crushed ore fall in a thin stream past such a magnet. The magnetic particles are attracted out of the straight line of the falling stream, and, being heavy, gravitate inwardly and fall to one side of a partition placed below. The non-magnetic gang descends in a straight line to the other side of the partition. Thus a complete separation is effected. Simple though the principle appears, it was in its application to vast masses of material, and in the solving of great engineering problems connected therewith, that Edison's originality made itself manifest in the concentrating works that he established in New Jersey early in the 90s. Not only did he develop thoroughly the refining of the crushed ore, so that after it had passed the 480 magnets in the mill, the concentrates came out finally 91% to 93% of iron oxide, but he also devised collateral machinery, methods, and processes, all fundamental in their nature. Mountains must be reduced to dust. All this dust must be handled in detail, so to speak, and from it must be separated the fine particles of iron, constituting only 1/4 or 1/5 of its mass. Then this iron ore dust must be put into such shape that it could be commercially shipped and used. One of the most interesting and striking investigations made by Edison in this connection is worthy of note and may be related in his own words. "I felt certain that there must be large bodies of magnetite in the East, which, if crushed and concentrated, would satisfy the wants of the Eastern furnaces for steel making. Having determined to investigate the mountain regions of New Jersey, I constructed a very sensitive magnetic needle, which would dip toward the earth if brought over any considerable body of magnetic iron ore. One of my laboratory assistants went out with me, and we visited many of the mines of New Jersey, but did not find deposits of any magnitude. One day, however, we drove over a mountain range, not known as iron-bearing land. I was astonished to find the needle was strongly attracted and remained so, thus indicating that the whole mountain was underlaid with a vast body of magnetic ore. I knew it was a commercial problem to produce high-grade Bessemer ore from these deposits, and took steps to acquire a large amount of the property. I also planned a great magnetic survey of the East, and I believe it remains the most comprehensive of its kind yet performed. I had a number of men survey a strip reaching from Lower Canada to North Carolina. The only instrument we used was the special magnetic needle. We started in Lower Canada and traveled across the line of march 25 miles, then advanced south 1,000 feet, then back across the line of march again 25 miles, then south another 1,000 feet, across again, and so on. Thus we advanced all the way to North Carolina, varying our cross-country march from 2 to 25 miles according to geological formation. Our magnetic needle indicated the presence and richness of the invisible deposits of magnetic ore. We kept minute records of these indications, and when the survey was finished, we had exact information of the deposits in every part of each state we had passed through. We also knew the width, length, and approximate depth of every one of these deposits, which were enormous. The amount of ore disclosed by this survey was simply fabulous. How much so may be judged from the fact that in 3,000 acres immediately surrounding the mills that I afterward established at Edison, there were 200 million tons of low-grade ore. I also secured 16,000 acres in which the deposit was proportionately as large. These few acres alone contain sufficient ore to supply the whole United States iron trade, including exports, for 70 years. Given a mountain of rock containing only 1/5 to 1/4 magnetic iron, the broad problem confronting Edison resolved itself into three distinct parts. First, to tear down the mountain bodily and grind it to powder. Second, to extract from this powder the particles of iron mingled in its mass. And third, to accomplish these results at a cost sufficiently low to give the product a commercial value. No such departure was as radical as that of the method of crushing the ore. Existing machinery for this purpose had been designed on the basis of mining methods then in vogue, by which the rock was thoroughly shattered by means of high explosives and reduced to pieces of 100 pounds or less. These pieces were then crushed by powder directly applied. If a concentrating mill planned to treat 5 or 6,000 tons per day were to be operated on this basis, the investment in crushers and the supply of powder would be enormous, to say nothing of the risk of frequent breakdowns by reason of multiplicity of machinery and parts. From a consideration of these facts, and with his usual tendency to upset traditional observances, Edison conceived the bold idea of constructing gigantic rolls which, by force of momentum, would be capable of crushing individual rocks of vastly greater size than ever before attempted. He reasoned that the advantage thus obtained would be fourfold: a minimum of machinery and parts, greater compactness, a savings of power and greater economy in mining. As this last-named operation precedes the crushing, let us first consider it as it was projected and carried on by him. Perhaps quarrying would be a better term than mining in this case, as Edison's plan was to approach the rock and tear it down bodily. The faith that moves mountains had a new opportunity. In work of this nature, it had been customary, as above stated, to depend upon high explosives such as dynamite to shatter and break down the ore to lumps of 100 pounds or less. This, however, he deemed to be a most uneconomical process, for energy stored as heat units in dynamite at $260 per ton was much more expensive than that of calories in a ton of coal at $3 per ton. Hence he believed that only the minimum of work should be done with a costly explosive, and therefore planned to use dynamite merely to dislodge great masses of rock, and depended upon the steam shovel operated by coal under the boiler to displace, handle, and remove the rock in detail. This was the plan that was subsequently put into practice in the great works at Edison, New Jersey. A series of 3-inch holes, 20 feet deep, were drilled 8 feet apart, about 12 feet back of the ore bank, and into these were inserted dynamite cartridges. The blast would dislodge 30 to 35,000 tons of rock, which was scooped up by great steam shovels and loaded onto skips carried by a line of cars on a narrow-gauge railroad running to and from the crushing mill. Here the material was automatically delivered to the giant rolls. The problem included handling and crushing the run of the mine without selection. The steam shovel did not discriminate, but picked up handily single pieces weighing 5 or 6 tons, and loaded them on skips with quantities of smaller lumps. When the skips arrived at the giant rolls, their content was dumped automatically into a superimposed hopper. The rolls were well named, for with ear-splitting noise they broke up in a few seconds the great pieces of rock tossed in from the skips. The giant rolls were 2 solid cylinders, 6 feet in diameter and 5 feet long, made of cast iron. To the faces of these rolls were bolted a series of heavy chilled iron plates, containing a number of projecting knobs 2 inches high. Each roll had also 2 rows of 4-inch knobs intended to strike a series of hammer-like blows. The rolls were set face to face 14 inches apart in a heavy frame, and the total weight was 130 tons, of which 70 tons were in moving parts. The space between these 2 rolls allowed pieces of rock measuring less than 14 inches to descend to other small rolls placed below. The giant rolls were belt-driven in opposite directions through friction clutches, although the belt was not depended upon for the actual crushing. Previous to the dumping of a skip, the rolls were speeded up to a circumferential velocity of nearly 1 mile a minute, thus imparting to them terrific momentum that would break up easily in a few seconds boulders weighing 5 or 6 tons each. It was as though a rock of this size had got in the way of 2 express trains traveling in opposite directions at nearly 60 miles an hour. In other words, it was the kinetic energy of the rolls that crumbled up the rocks with pile-driver effect. This sudden strain might have tended to stop the engine driving the rolls, but by an ingenious clutch arrangement, the belt was released at the moment of resistance in the rolls by reason of the rocks falling between them. The act of breaking and crushing would naturally decrease the tremendous momentum, but after the rock was reduced and the pieces had passed through, and once more speed up the rolls for a repetition of their regular prize-fighter duty. On leaving the giant rolls, the rocks, having been reduced to pieces not larger than 14 inches, passed into a series of intermediate rolls of similar construction and operation, by which they were still further reduced and again passed on to three other sets of rolls of smaller dimensions. These latter rolls were also face-lined with chilled iron plates, but unlike the larger ones, were positively driven, reducing the rock to pieces of about 1/2 inch size or smaller. The whole crushing operation of reduction from massive boulders to small pebbly pieces having been done in less time than the telling has occupied. The product was conveyed to the dryer, a tower 9 feet square and 50 feet high, heated from below by great open furnace fires. All down the inside walls of this tower were placed cast iron plates, 9 feet long and 7 inches wide, arranged alternately in fish ladder fashion. The crushed rock being delivered at the top would fall down from plate to plate, constantly exposing different surfaces to the heat until it landed completely dried in the lower portion of the tower, where it fell into conveyors which took it up to the stockhouse. This method of drying was original with Edison. At the time this adjunct to the plant was required, the best dryer on the market was of a rotary type, which had a capacity of only 20 tons per hour, with the expenditure of considerable power. As Edison had determined upon treating 250 tons or more per hour, he decided to devise an entirely new type of great capacity, requiring a minimum of power for elevating the material, and depending upon the force of gravity for handling it during the drying process. A long series of experiments resulted in the invention of the tower dryer with a capacity of 300 tons per hour. The rock, broken up into pieces about the size of marbles, having been dried and conveyed to the stockhouse, the surplusage was automatically carried out the other end of the stockhouse by conveyors to pass through the next process, by which it was reduced to a powder. The machinery for accomplishing this result represented another interesting and radical departure of Edison from accepted usage. He had investigated all the crushing machines on the market and tried all he could get. He found them all greatly lacking in economy of operation. Indeed, the highest result obtainable from the best were 18% of actual work, involving a loss of 82% by friction. His nature revolted at such an immense loss of power, especially as he proposed the crushing of vast quantities of ore. Thus he was obliged to begin again at the foundation, and he devised a crushing machine which was subsequently named the Three High Rolls, and which practically reversed the above figures as it developed 84% of work done with only 16% loss in friction. In the two end pieces of a heavy iron frame were set three rolls or cylinders, one in the center, another below, and the other above, all three being in a vertical line. These rolls were of cast iron, 3 feet in diameter, having chilled iron smooth face plates of considerable thickness. The lowest roll was set in a fixed bearing at the bottom of the frame and therefore could only turn around on its axis. The middle and top rolls were free to move up and down and toward the lower roll, and the shafts of the middle and upper rolls were set in a loose bearing which could slip up and down in the iron frame. It will be apparent, therefore, that any material which passed in between the top and middle rolls and the middle and bottom rolls could be ground as fine as might be desired, depending entirely upon the amount of pressure applied in the loose rolls. In operation, the material passed first through the upper and middle rolls, and then between the middle and lowest rolls. The pressure was applied in a most ingenious manner. On the ends of the shafts of the bottom and top rolls, there were cylindrical sleeves or bearings having 7 sheaves in which was run a 1/2-inch endless wire rope. The rope was round 7 times over the sheaves as above, and led upward and over a single groove sheave, which was operated by the piston of an air cylinder, and in this manner the pressure was applied to the rolls. It will be seen, therefore, that the system consisted of a single rope passed over sheaves and so arranged that it could be varied in length, thus providing for elasticity and exerting pressure and regulating it as desired. The efficiency of this system was incomparably greater than that of any known crusher or grinder, for while a pressure of 125,000 pounds could be exerted by these rolls, friction was almost entirely eliminated because the upper and lower roll bearings turned with the rolls and revolved in the wire rope which constituted the bearing proper. The same cautious foresight exercised by Edison in providing a safety device, the fuse, to prevent fires in his electric light system, was again displayed in this concentrating plant, where, to save possible injury to its expensive operating parts, he devised an analogous factor, providing all the crushing machinery with closely calculated safety pins, which on being overloaded would shear off and thus stop the machine at once. The rocks having thus been reduced to fine powder, the mass was ready for screening on its way to the magnetic separators. Here again Edison reversed prior practice by discarding rotary screens and devising a form of tower screen, which, besides having a very large working capacity by gravity, eliminated all power except that required to elevate the material. The screening process allowed the finest part of the crushed rock to pass on by conveyor belt to the magnetic separators, while the coarser particles were in like manner automatically returned to the rolls for further reduction. At the start, the weakest magnet at the top frees the purest particles, and the second takes care of others, but the third catches those to which rock adheres and will extract particles of which only 1/8 is iron. This batch material goes back for another crushing, so that everything is subjected to an equality of refining. We are now in sight of the real concentrates, which are conveyed to dryer number 2 for drying again, and are then delivered to the 50 mesh screens. Whatever is fine enough goes through the 8-inch magnets, and the remainder goes back for recrushing. Below the 8-inch magnets, the dust is blown out of particles mechanically, and they go to the 4-inch magnets for final cleansing and separation. Obviously, at each step, the percentage of feldspar and phosphorus is less and less, until in the final concentrates, the percentage of iron oxide is 91% to 93%. As intimated at the outset, the tailings will be 75% of the rock taken from the veins of ore, so that every 4 tons of crude, raw, low-grade ore will have yielded roughly 1 ton of high-grade concentrate and 3 tons of sand, the latter also having its value in various ways. The sand was transported automatically by belt conveyors to the rear of the works to be stored and sold. Being sharp, crystalline, and even in quality, it was a valuable byproduct, finding a ready sale for building purposes, railway sandboxes, and various industrial uses. The concentrate in fine powdery form was delivered in a similar manner to a stockhouse. As to the next step in the process, we may now quote again from the article in the Iron Age. While Mr. Edison and his associates were working on the problem of cheap concentration of iron ore, an added difficulty faced them in the preparation of the concentrates for the market. Furnace men object to more than a very small portion of fine ore in their mixture, particularly when the ore is magnetic, not easily reduced. The problem to be solved was to market an agglomerated material so as to avoid the drawback of fine ore. The agglomerated product must be porous so as to affect access to the furnace-reducing gases to the ore. It must be hard enough to bear transportation and to carry the furnace burden without crumbling to pieces. It must be waterproof to a certain extent, because considerations connected with the securing low rates of freight make it necessary to be able to ship the concentrates to market in open coal cars exposed to snow and rain. In many respects, the attainment of these somewhat conflicting ends was the most perplexing of the problems which confronted Mr. Edison. The agglomeration of the concentrates having been decided upon, two other considerations not mentioned above were of primary importance. First, to find a suitable cheap binding material, and second, its nature must be such that very little would be necessary per ton of concentrates. These severe requirements were staggering, but Mr. Edison's courage did not falter. Although it seemed a well-nigh hopeless task, he entered upon the investigation with his usual optimism and vim. After many months of unremitting toil and research and the trial of thousands of experiments, the goal was reached in the completion of a successful formula for agglomerating the fine ore and pressing it into briquettes by special machinery. Briefly described, the process consisted in mixing the concentrates with the special binding material in machines of an entirely new type, and in passing the resultant pasty mass into the briquetting machines, where it was pressed into cylindrical cakes 3 inches in diameter and 1.5 inches thick under successive pressures of 7,800, 14,000, and 60,000 pounds. Each machine made these briquettes at the rate of 60 per minute and dropped them into a bucket conveyor by which they were carried into drying furnaces through which they made 5 loops and were then delivered to cross conveyors which carried them into the stockhouses. At the end of this process, the briquettes were so hard that they would not break or crumble in loading on the cars or in transportation by rail, while they were so porous as to be capable of absorbing 26% of their own volume in alcohol, but repelling water absolutely. Perfect old soaks. Thus, with never-failing persistence and patience, coupled with intense thought and hard work, Edison met and conquered one by one the complex difficulties that confronted him. And it is now to be noted that the product he had striven so sedulously to obtain was a highly commercial ore, for not only did the briquette of concentrated ore fulfill the purpose of their creation, but in actual use tended to increase the working capacity of the furnace, as the following test quoted from Iron Age, October 28, 1897, will attest. The only trial of any magnitude of the briquettes in the blast furnace was carried on early this year at the Crane Iron Works. The richness of the ore and its purity, of course, affect the limestone consumption. In the case of the Crane trial, there was a reduction from 30% to 12% of the ore charge. Finally, the fuel consumption is reduced, which in the case of the eastern plants with their relatively costly coke is a very important consideration. It is regarded as possible that eastern furnaces will be able to use a smaller portion of the costlier coke and correspondingly increase in anthracite coal, which is a cheaper fuel in that section. So far as foundry iron is concerned, the experience at Crane, brief as it has been, shows that a stronger and tougher metal is made. Edison himself tells an interesting little story in this connection, when he enjoyed the active help of that noble character John Fritz, the distinguished inventor and pioneer of the modern steel industry in America. He says, "When I was struggling along with the iron ore concentration, I went to see several blast furnace men to sell the ore at the market price. They saw I was very anxious to sell it, and they would take advantage of my necessity. But I happened to go to Mr. John Fritz of the Bethlehem Steel Company and told him what I was doing. 'Well,' he said to me, 'Edison, you are doing a good thing for the eastern furnaces. They ought to help you, for it will help us out. I'm willing to help you. I mix a little sentiment with business, and I will give you an order for 100,000 tons. And he sat right down and gave me the order. Edison's native shrewdness and knowledge of human nature was put to practical use in the busy days of plant construction. It was found impossible to keep mechanics on account of indifferent residential accommodations afforded by the tiny village remote from civilization among the central mountains of New Jersey. This puzzling question was much discussed between him and his associate, Mr. W.S. Mallory, until finally he said to the latter, "If we want to keep the men here, we must make it attractive for the women. So let us build some houses that will have running water and electric lights, and rent at a low rate." He set to work and in a day finished a design for a type of house. 50 were quickly built and fully described in advertising for mechanics. 3 days' advertisements brought in over 650 applications, and afterward Edison had no trouble in obtaining all the first-class men he required as settlers in the artificial Yosemite he was creating. The facts of this actual test are far more eloquent than volumes of argument would be as a justification of Edison's assiduous labors for over 8 years, and of the expenditure of a fortune in bringing his broad conceptions to a concrete possibility. In the patient solving of tremendous problems, he had toiled up the mountainside of success, scaling its topmost peak and obtaining a view of the boundless prospect. But alas, the discovery of great deposits of rich Bessemer ore in the Mesaba Range of Mountains in Minnesota a year or two previous to the completion of his work had been followed by the opening up of those deposits and the marketing of the ore. It was of such a rich character that being cheaply mined by greatly improved and inexpensive methods, the market price of crude ore of like iron units fell from about $6.50 to $3.50 per ton at the time when Edison was ready to supply his concentrated product. At the former price, he could have supplied the market and earned a liberal profit on his investment. But at $3.50 per ton, he was left without a reasonable chance of competition. Thus was swept away the possibility of reaping the reward so richly earned by years of insistent thought, labor, and care. From Mr. Mallory we have this account. During the latter part of the panic of 1893, there came a period when we were very hard up for cash due largely to the panicky conditions, and a large payroll had been raised with considerable difficulty. A short time before payday, our treasurer called me by telephone and said, "I've just received the paid checks from the bank, and I am fearful that my assistant, who has forged my name to some of the checks, has absconded with about $3,000. I went immediately to Mr. Edison and told him of the forgery and the amount of money taken, and in what an embarrassing position we were for the next payday. When I had finished, he said, "It's too bad the money is gone, but I'll tell you what to do. Go and see the president of the bank which paid the forged checks. Get him to admit the bank's liability, and then say to him that Mr. Edison does not think the bank should suffer because he happened to have a dishonest clerk in his employ. Also say to him that I shall not ask them to make the amount good." This was done, the bank admitting its liability and being much pleased with this action. When I reported to Mr. Edison, he said, "That's all right. We have made a friend of the bank, and we may need friends later on." And so it happened that some time afterward, when we greatly needed help in the way of loans, the bank willingly gave us the accommodations we required to tide us over a critical period. In view of its present status, this colossal enterprise at Edison may well be likened to the prologue of a play that is to be subsequently enacted for the benefit of future generations. But before ringing down the curtain, it is desirable to preserve the unities by quoting the words of one of the principal actors, Mr. Mallory, who says, "The concentrating works had been in operation, and we had produced a considerable quantity of the briquettes, and had been able to sell only a portion of them, the iron market being in such a condition that blast furnaces were not making any new purchases of iron ore, and were having difficulty to receive and consume the ores which had been previously contracted for. So what sales we were able to make were at extremely low prices, My recollection being that they were between $3.50 and $3.80 per ton, whereas when the work had started we had hoped to obtain $6 to $6.50 per ton for the briquettes. We had also thoroughly investigated the wonderful deposit at Mesaba, and it was with the greatest possible reluctance that Mr. Edison was able to come finally to the conclusion that under the existing conditions, the concentrating plant could not be made a commercial success. When this decision was reached, Mr. Edison and I took the Jersey Central train from Edison bound for Orange, and I did not look forward to the immediate future with any degree of confidence, as the concentrating plant was heavily in debt without any early prospect of being able to pay off its indebtedness. On the train, the matter of the future was discussed, and Mr. Edison said that inasmuch as we had the knowledge gained from our experiences in the concentrating problem, we must, if possible, apply it to some practical use, and at the same time we must work out some other plans by which we could make enough money to pay off the concentrating company's indebtedness. Mr. Edison, stating most positively that no company with which he had personally been actively connected had ever failed to pay its debts, and he did not propose to have the concentrating company any exception. In the discussion that followed, he suggested several kinds of work which he had in his mind and which might prove profitable. We figured carefully over the probabilities of financial returns from the phonograph works and other enterprises, and after discussing many plans, it was finally decided that we would apply the knowledge we had gained in the concentrating plant by building a plant for manufacturing Portland cement, and that Mr. Edison would devote his attention to the developing of a storage battery which did not use lead and sulfuric acid. So these two lines of work were taken up by Mr. Edison with just as much enthusiasm and energy as is usual with him. The commercial failure of the concentrating plant seeming not to affect his spirits in any way. In fact, I have often been impressed strongly with the fact that during the dark days of the concentrating problem, Mr. Edison's desire was very strong that the creditors of the concentrating work should be paid in full, and only once did I hear him make any reference to the financial loss which he himself made, and then he said, "As far as I am concerned, I can any time get a job at $75 per month as a telegrapher, and that will amply take care of my personal requirements." As already stated, however, he started in with the maximum amount of enthusiasm and ambition, and in the course of about 3 years we succeeded in paying off all the indebtedness of the concentrating works, which amounted to several $100,000. It will have been gathered that the funds for this great experiment were furnished largely by Edison. In fact, over $2 million were spent in the attempt. Edison's philosophic view of affairs is given in the following anecdote from Mr. Mallory. During the boom times of 1902, when the old General Electric stock sold at its high water mark of about $330, Mr. Edison and I were on our way from the cement plant at New Village, New Jersey, to his home at Orange. When we arrived at Dover, New Jersey, we got a New York newspaper, and I called his attention to the quotation of that day on General Electric. Mr. Edison then asked, "If I hadn't sold any of mine, what would it be worth today?" And after some figuring, I replied, "Over $4 million. When Mr. Edison is thinking seriously over a problem, he is in the habit of pulling his right eyebrow, which he did now for 15 or 20 seconds. Then his face lighted up and he said, "Well, it's all gone, but we had a hell of a good time spending it."